Tonight we're drinking. I've got a. This is a Bud Light from the Bud Light company.
There you go.
Get that sound effect, just like your show, right there. We start every show like this. But
oh my god!
Look,
you're ruining my desk.
Don't think that we don't. This is how we start every episode. And
no, that's how you clean your desk.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you spill beer and you wipe it off.
Yeah, little company called Bud Light. Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
We have a
big Budweiser plant in Columbus.
Oh, really?
Oh, wonderful, yeah. Wonderful.
Nice. And tonight...
I know you guys on your own show enjoy like little indie companies like Bud Light. So.
So we thought we would pay tribute to your show by getting some indie beers like Bud Light. And I've got...
We went to the store and we literally... I was like, what's the lamest beer that I could pick for the captain?
I drank a lot of Bud Lights.
And, well, look at that. He ended up enjoying it. And this is actually Nick's first beer ever.
Yeah, so tonight, I don't even know how to open a can of beer.
This guy doesn't drink.
You never drink a beer?
Tonight, we're drinking O'Doul's. And, John, can you open this one?
Yeah, you really messed that up pretty bad.
Oh, God,
huh?
I got it.
You are drinking... really?
That's gross.
That's not a Killian's Irish Red?
It's not. That's my dad's favorite beer, is Killian's Irish Red.
I used to drink that all the time.
Yeah, haven't had one since.
It smells disgusting.
Does it?
Yeah.
Have you ever had an O'Doul's, Captain?
Never. Why?
Me neither. I don't
right?
know.
So, here's the thing is I don't drink alcohol because I'm Mormon. That's not true, but I like to say it because it's funny. but I wanted to get in the spirit for this episode, so I did get a non-alcoholic
Let's see
beer.
If we could get a nice, like, a surround sound, like turn your mic around, like a nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't turn my mic around, but.
That was a good one. That was a good one.
It's pretty good. What are you drinking over there?
I'm actually drinking a hot chocolate.
Oh, well.
It's not even coffee. It's like a hot chocolate.
The tables have turned.
That's actually what I get when I go to Starbucks because I hate coffee too. I'm just a horrible human being.
Well, I had my, like I said, I had my nephews over and their little kids and they wanted hot chocolate. So
they're not big O'Doul's fans?
No, I gave them a couple beers earlier to settle them down. Yeah.
So real fast, just on the air, I'm going to drink this.
Yeah.
First ever, any sort of beer
I'd
ever.
Like to take a sip though, because I want to know if it's going to be.
There's some in there, in the bottle.
Okay. Yeah. I want to know how it tastes.
Oh, it smells so bad.
Oh, that's terrible, dude.
Oh,
you're going to hate beer forever.
Oh.
It tastes like metal.
So why don't you drink beer?
My burps taste like
he
beer.
Just never did growing up.
Oh, I want to vomit.
If like a year from now he's an alcoholic, I apologize.
This is his entryway. Was a gimmick because we had you on.
That was disgusting.
Even though it does taste like mercury.
It tastes like soda water. Should we hop into this episode?
Yeah.
As you've undoubtedly understood by now, you're listening to Stranger Still.
Podcast where we answer strange questions you never thought to ask.
I'm Nick Wood.
I'm John Began.
And with us today, we have a very special guest. Probably the most experty expert we've ever had on our show.
Sure.
And I'll let him introduce himself. The Captain.
I am the Captain from True Crime Garage. Or like they like to say overseas, True Crime Garage. And we do a weekly True Crime podcast.
I guess we've probably already played this gag, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, we played. So it's weird. It's weird hearing you introduce yourself without hearing beer pouring immediately after.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We got that done.
So the reason that we have this beer gag is because at the True Crime Garage, you guys drink beer every episode. Where did that begin, by the way? I'm just curious.
Nick is a very strange bird, and and we were hanging out in his garage. We actually record in my garage now, but we used to record in his garage.
Yeah,
and
So it's not the True Crime Garage, it's like the fake crime garage.
Yeah, well, to me, wherever I'm at is the real garage. But so we're both laid
home
off.
Home is where your garage is. Is that how the saying goes? Sorry.
We were both laid off, and he said to me, let's start a podcast. And I was like, okay, about what? And he said, I got it all figured out. It's going to be a true crime show, and we're going to do a weekly beer. And I'm like, what does beer have to do with true crime? But he's actually a really big drinker. I am not.
Yeah.
So the beer thing is more his thing than my thing.
Yes.
So there's a lot of episodes that people claim that I'm drunk, but that episode I might I always taste the beer of the week.
Yeah.
But there's sometimes I do all the recording and all the production, and he just sits in the corner and talks. So, and we edit live. So
We don't edit post.
If somebody messes up, I stop it. And so we edit the show as we go. So when the show is done, I hit print and it's done.
Nice.
So,
that's awesome.
Wish we could do that.
Figure it out.
You could, but it's, I don't know. I don't know why we started doing it that way, but we started doing it that way. But the beer is more his thing. And also, I talk a lot openly about it on the show, but you know, I deal with a lot of depression. So drinking constantly is not the most healthy thing for somebody with that condition. So,
that's kind of a hard decision for someone with depression to make. Like, I don't want to feed into the beast, so to speak.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't. I mean, the funny thing is, before we started the show, I never bought alcohol for my house before.
Yeah.
So now I have all these like specialty beers in my
refrigerator.
People
are sending to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do drink. I don't want to make it sound like, oh well, I got depression. I don't drink often. I drink a couple times a week. So.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, fair enough.
Well, I was going to say, but now everybody's doing it. It's like. There's wine and crime, wine and true crime.
Getting frisky with whiskey. I heard that.
Yeah. But I think we were one of the first.
Yeah. I got one quick story about this whole beer drinking thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll get into the content of this episode. Cause I want to tell this story on the air so bad. I started doing a podcast with my dad. We talk about cartoons. We just started like 10 weeks ago or something.
Right.
And I was explaining your podcast to him. I don't remember when this was. But I was like, every episode they start off drinking some sort of beer. He does home brewing. And he's like, oh my God, can I start doing that? I was like, I really don't care. If you want to, you can. He hasn't yet. I'm just waiting for that day.
well, and also it'd be cool if he tried a new batch and then he just gave the recipe on how he did it. Would be kind of cool.
That would be rad.
Name it after the cartoon we're doing.
There you go. Yeah, his podcast is about Hanna-Barbera stuff, so it's Drunken Flintstones and Drunken Scooby-Doo.
We'll call this one Bedrock because that's where you reach once you drink this one.
Yeah.
So without further ado, I think the reason we wanted to get you on here, Captain, and... John, for a certain extent, I can't do this without both of you, is because today we're going to be talking about how scary music or music for horror is made and how it affects us as people. So last week we talked about how horror movies affect, how horror movies affect your body. Now we can get into how the music itself has a separate effect than the movie itself, mm-hmm. which is really interesting. I kind of want to start things off by asking both of you guys, whoever wants to go first, if you were to sit down and start writing a song for a horror film or just any sort of horror, what would you do to write that song? How would you start out?
I could go first a little bit.
Yeah.
So I recently did compose for a horror film.
Yeah.
My friend wrote a zombie movie that was like a Walking Dead parody. And that was John Mangione, who's been on our show.
Yeah.
He did that and premiered it at a couple of film festivals. And I think that what we're going to allude to a lot here is that tone is more important than melody when it comes to horror.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of string ramps, a lot of Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Start low, get high.
Yeah.
That's what they say.
Yeah,
it's a case-by-case basis. It's really personal, and it's hard to pinpoint exactly what you would do.
That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you would agree that it's just whatever state you're in. I mean, there's two forms of composing. I think to me you're in your garage having a beer, and somehow the universe gave you some kind of tune in your head.
Mm-hmm.
There's that kind of composing where it just something happens and you're inspired and you go do it. And then there's the other kind of composing where it's just time. You don't, you know, your buddy asked you to do something and you're running out of time. So you have to sit down.
Yeah.
So I think then it becomes, I think for me, a lot of times it's what there's rules and we're probably going to talk about that as far as the theory goes.
Uh-huh.
But I think a lot of it, it's also just You can go with the rules or you can just go with your gut feeling. And I think that's what you're saying. Like with like, well, I started off and I got these little swells going or whatever it is. And it's like sometimes that it just takes a timbre of an instrument to strike an idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what instruments would you start off with if you're trying to get in the mindset of a horror sound?
That's super personal to the project too, and what tone the director wants.
Let's say it's a zombie film.
I always start with synthetic instruments just to build a pad in the background for the tone.
Yeah.
So once you set the tone, you can put any melody you want over it.
Yeah.
And I like to have a drone in the background. But it does depend on exactly what you're composing.
I think a lot of horror music composers start with synth, which is where you get like Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th. Like all of that is very synthy.
Sure, but yeah, but again, like you said, the captain. It depends on the logistics of it too, and how much time you got. Because sometimes you get down to, okay, I've got this idea. I'm super stoked. I'm ready to jump into it. Or, hey, we need this in a couple of days. And then that has its own merits because you get that like rush of energy in the last minute. But
yeah, and I think if you look at like some of the major horror themes, for example, we talked about Halloween. Halloween's theme, you can actually sing. But then if you take like something like Nightmare on Elm Street and you listen to that theme, you can't sing that theme. It's just a bunch of weird textures and noises. So I think it's like you were saying, it depends on what the director is thinking. But it's weird too, because like, you know, I write a new song every week for the show. And so now I've done about like over 100.
Right.
And it's true crime, but you would argue that it's still in the same genre as like horror or like suspense.
Oh, it's so, it's reality horror.
Yeah, it's real life horror.
Yeah, and so it's weird because like the same thing where sometimes you're pulling up some synth sound because you're just trying to get some kind of texture, but sometimes I force myself to just pull up a piano sound first because sometimes that's harder, because then you have to actually force yourself to create some kind of melody. And that's one of the interesting things, as we were talking about horror films, I was looking up all these horror tunes and I realized so many of them, they don't actually have a melody.
No,
right.
There's nothing you can sing, and it's like, or
especially modern.
Oh yeah,
because in the '80s it was all '80s hair metal that had lyrics with the title of the movie in them.
Yeah. Right, right.
But now, yeah, it's all just like sounds.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you bring up like the idea that Nightmare on Elm Street is just like chaotic, and that actually is kind of the leading theory on scary music right now, is called nonlinear chaotic noise. That's the official name for it. And we'll talk about the effects this has on your brain, starting with a study from this guy named Daniel Blumstein. He did a couple studies. It's really interesting because he started off his entire studies on animal baby cries, and he got to the conclusion that this nonlinear chaotic noise that animal babies make when they're crying for help is what scares us in horror music.
Okay.
He made this like really weird leap. So nonlinear chaotic noise just means that there's all these sounds that are disjointed. So I'll probably splice some music in here, like the Nightmare on Elm Street theme. Like you said, it's just noise. It's just meant to jostle you around. There's no melody to it. There's no rhyme or reason.
Yeah, I mean, there's a rhyme or reason, but it's like, I mean, because they put that stuff in there to be chaotic.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's meant to create a dissonance, is what it really is, and any sort of note dissonance musically is going to be unsettling to us. We're not used to that. Not only that, but the way that he found this out is he put the label nonlinear chaotic noise on like animal baby cries and found out that when an animal cries, it has an effect on us, the same effect that it would have on the animal's parent. Mm-hmm. And the reason that is because we feel subconsciously that our young of the tribe mentality, the young is threatened despite what animal is making that noise. So when you throw that principle into music and you start making all this dissonance, just random, seemingly random noises and all that dissonance, that's when it has an effect on us musically, which right. I think is so cool.
When was this study done?
This was done recently. I think it was like 2008. I thought I had dates in here, but I don't. What he did, there's another study outside of the animal baby noises where he took music composers and he asked them to utilize the idea of nonlinear chaotic noise and basically proved that if they used that, it had a more profound effect on people. Ta-da!
Yeah.
There's also social implications on horror music. I won't spend too much time on this because obviously we're just conditioned to think certain noises are creepy. Mm-hmm. The biggest example I think of is like music box noises, like the, I don't know what you want to call that.
Yeah, it's just a music box. You wind it up, and
yeah,
they're technically just like little tiny chimes almost.
Yeah, like so, the bell drum or whatever, the tiny little nodules.
And what's crazy to your point is that texture, that music box texture. I mean, obviously, it's more creepy if you're playing tones that are dissonant or tones that are going to be clashing with one another. But even if you play something pretty on it, there's almost something haunting about that as well.
Yeah, it goes into a weirder, deeper psychological thing because it brings you back to childhood because we're a lot of baby toys.
A lot more fears back then too.
Right.
Like your closet's scary and
sure.
The little space under your bed is scary.
We start developing fears in childhood, but beyond that,
but the question is the music box actually scary because of the childhood, or was it because they placed music boxes? And how many
maybe
horror
we're conditioned.
Movies?
Yeah,
and now we're conditioned to go, hey, that's kind of a scary tone.
I think that's absolutely what it is. Because my wife, I've never told her this, and she's probably going to listen to this and be like, what the hell? But she had a music box, and she would play it because it soothed her, and it would always scare the living crap out of me. And I think that's because I've watched way too many horror movies for any reasonable human being. But
I got this... I have this weird music box story. So it was actually electric piano. It was really tiny. It's set on a desk. It was maybe 5 inches long and 5 inches deep.
Like
and
a
on top
Casio thing.
No, it was like it looked like a baby grand piano, and you could actually play it. But it was electronic, and on top of the piano was this giant bulb, about the size of a softball, and the thing would glow. And it would change colors as you played it.
Huh.
And but the keyboard sound, like the tuning of the piano sound was always off a little bit. So no matter what you played, it was just so creepy. But well, the crazy thing about this thing was when it had a plug and it had batteries.
Yeah.
And
batteries die and it gets creepier, huh?
You know what was crazy? It was plugged into the wall for the longest time. I'd have it plugged into the wall.
Yep.
But it would randomly like be like ding dong.
Oh, ding, no, ding. Thank you.
Or it'd randomly like start glowing. And so I was like,
Burn your house down.
Well, I need to unplug this, right?
Yeah.
So I ended up unplugging it and taking the batteries out. And my father swears that he heard it multiple times. I swear that it would glow multiple times to the point, where like the girlfriend that gave it to me was totally fine with me throwing it away because
oh my God,
it was just the weirdest thing.
Did you buy it from an ancient Chinese gremlin salesman?
Yeah. No, I she got it when she was like a little kid or something. But it was like one of those things where it's like, you know, a lot of people. It's a weird thing with true crime. There's this. There's like true crime, and then there's a small percentage of people that are into true crime that are also into like paranormal activity and stuff like that.
You got a crossover.
Diagram, yeah.
Yeah, so people will always ask us, like, do you believe in it or anything? And one of the only stories I can say is, I know that when I was laying in my bed once, it started glowing blue. And I was thinking, I know I unplugged it, and I know there's no batteries in it. I don't know how to explain that.
So, yeah. No thanks, dude.
Well, I was going to say, that's all subjective, you know. And a lot of times when people are composing stuff, they say that they have some, you know, this is the way I create magic, but that's not how it always happens. You know,
yeah, it's all, like, it's so personal, which is what makes everything so subjective and hard to study and figure out.
Yeah. Yeah. There, obviously, let's say it this way.
Okay.
There are some lazy ways to make horror music, and there's some really effective ways to make horror music. So I want to start with the laziest in my unqualified opinion and work our way towards the most effective.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reality is the more of these that you use in combination with one another are the most effective. But I think the quickest and easiest way to make horror music is to use an instrument in a way it's not meant to be used. So you said, like, sometimes you'll just pull up a piano and you'll start playing. I'm curious to know where on the keyboard do you start playing when you're composing horror music?
Well, when I started doing the show, at first it was like just a wealth of stuff I haven't used in a long time.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I primarily write a lot of pop stuff, or like I do a lot of commercial stuff. So one of the last projects I did, the producer, I normally just tell the producer, what band do you want me to sound like? And yeah. So the last big project I did, they're like, Ben Folds.
Mm.
So it's like, well, one, I'm not that good of a piano player. So I'm like, okay, let's figure this one out. But he kind of has this thing. So, you know, it was mainly get a decent piano sound, get an upright bass sound, and some, you know, kind of pseudo rocking drums. Boom, done. But with horror, or even true crime, it's like there's certain notes that work.
Uh-huh.
That because of the theory of it is that they always work.
Yeah.
But then it's to be creative with that over and over. Yeah. So like the theme that I did for last week's show is actually two themes that I did before, but I cut both of them in half and figured out how I could put them both together. Now somebody would say, well, that's lazy. I would say, it's creative. You know, yeah, that's what I'd say. So, So there are just theories that work as far as certain notes that are going to work better. But it was probably a few months in. Have you ever seen those ads pop up on like Facebook that say like masterclass with Steve Martin, and it's a masterclass with, and there's a new one out, a masterclass with Martin Scorsese or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But there was one with Hans Zimmerman.
That's the one that pops up for me, is the Hans Zimmerman one. Yeah.
And he says, I always compose. I think that's how he talks. He's like, I always compose in D minor. And then he says, oh, here's a question. Oh, that's a dodgy question. And I don't know why, but ever since then, like probably 90% of what I write for the show is in D minor.
Really nice.
Yeah.
What I came across is a lot of people, the reason I originally asked is that I came across a lot of people will usually start on either the really high end of the piano or the really low end of the piano, and not a lot around middle C, because you're used to middle C. You're used to that sort of range. So a lot of people will go on those other ends just so you're uncomfortable with the usage of notes.
Sure. Yeah, especially when you're a little kid. I remember playing the lowest two keys on the piano. And dun, 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 dun. And my parents would be like, look, this is Jaws. You can play Jaws. Oh. Yeah. And that was probably my first horror song that I ever covered.
Well, no, but
done that.
Well, yeah, I get your idea. And that's a smart technique, though, is use the... But the timbre is going to be different because the piano has a hard time with the low notes keeping...
Yeah.
Because like, there becomes a dissonance just within that note.
Where you can't stay tuned. Yeah.
Right. And then same way with the high end. So if you do extreme low and extreme high, you're going to have this little bit of an out of tune effect.
Yes.
But and that adds to the creepiness too.
Yeah. It makes you uneasy.
But I'd say as a composer, though, one of the things that I thought was interesting about Hans Zimmerman's theory was he just always uses D minor.
Yeah.
And what's cool about that is you start figuring out when you're looking for that sound.
Yeah.
You already know where it's at because you've composed so many times in this key, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's just like
it makes it easier to start with a template.
Yeah. It's like a well-worn glove, right? Mm-hmm. I think the best example I have of instruments being used in a weird way is obviously violins. You have like the violin swells, squeaky violins.
Mm-hmm.
If you go like way too high on those things, it makes you uncomfortable. And it's effective to a certain point, but all you have to do is rub the bow the wrong way, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, when we're looking up the different theme songs, The Ring, for example, I thought they did something kind of cool. It wasn't so much the notes that made it creepy. It was more the fact that it was this piano in a very far distant hallway. And for some reason, that kind of has a creepy factor.
Yeah,
and I have no clue why, you know. Yeah, you could fill the space, yeah.
There was a, and this, I don't know how unrelated this might be, but...
who cares? That's never stopped us before.
Sure, Under Oath.
Yeah.
There's one of their newer albums, I remember, they have a screamer and they have a singer, and I remember, what's his face, the singer, they record their vocals in the same space instead of recording them separately because there's a creepiness to them recording in the same room. So Screamer stands far back in a hallway, and then Aaron, who's the singer in Under Oath, sang way back further, and they recorded their vocals and screaming at the same time, which means they couldn't use any like auto-tuning or editing or anything. But you could feel the atmosphere of it rather than recording everything dry and adding synthetic reverb.
Yeah.
Right.
It was all in the same room. And there's something about the fact that you can hear echoing off of drywall.
Yeah.
That you could feel the space out. And it kind of makes you feel
lonely. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know what that exactly is, but if you're out in the woods alone and you hear a far off cricket or a far off owl, there's just like this sense of.
Well, right, nothing. But I think also just in your house. I used to live in a cabin in the woods.
Oh my god!
And I was surrounded, so like I didn't really have neighbors. And it was this very interesting house because I only owned 2 acres, but there was like 200 acres of farm that surrounded me. Mm-hmm. So I was
free corn.
Yeah,
I get it. We've all been there.
Yeah,
but there was something about, you know, when you're at home alone. And you hear a noise in the basement, or you hear a noise
absolutely.
In the kitchen. And I think maybe that's the whole idea of the piano down the hall.
Yeah.
You know, why that is kind of like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
We're kind psychologically, of
conditioned to that. It's not close and warm and dry sounding. It's far away, and it's something to investigate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice way of putting it. There's also, I came across a bunch of instruments that are specifically designed around being spooky, or they're mostly exclusively used in horror music. Some of these have been used in like orchestras and stuff, but like most of these are in horror music. So I don't know if you guys know what the waterphone is. Have you ever heard of that?
Yep, love it. Want one?
But... Yeah, they're apparently really expensive. It's just like. I don't even know. It's like a circle of different length pipes, and like you either hit it with a rod or you like play it with a bow.
Yeah.
And it just makes like this weird, I don't even know what to call it. It's almost like Eastern sound? I don't know.
It's like a nice acoustic texture to add to horror. But the cool part about the waterphone is that it has a really high resonance. So you hit it and it rings and rings and stays.
Yeah.
And kind of fades out.
Yeah.
So that's cool to add as a texture.
Yeah. It's a weird sound. There's also the theremin, which I think is the most popular instrument of horror music enthusiasts. That's the one that's like, make the noise, John.
Yeah, that's perfect. You don't even need to buy one now.
Thank you.
Actually, one of our past guests, Matt, is a huge theremin enthusiast, right?
Yeah, he plays it.
Yeah.
He plays one. We should have him on soon.
Yeah. But this, it's like, it uses an antenna and your hand's relative location to it to make this weird, not quite synthy, definitely not organic, spooky sound.
Yeah, you could play, like, Good Vibrations by the Beatles, or by Beach Boys. I think that's one of the only pop songs that actually use one.
But maybe that's the reason that it's so creepy too, is it's not well known.
Yeah.
So it's got this like when someone first discovered synths.
Yeah.
Or synthetic instruments, everyone in the '80s was like, "Oh my god, this is amazing! We need to use this for everything." Yeah. Oh, it's so futuristic. Let's play this for everything. So for theremin, you put it in Good Vibrations in the '60s. Nothing after.
Yeah.
So that kind of adds to the, like, unknown, mysterious factor to it.
Yeah.
Especially that it's played by your hands. That adds to it, too. The visual.
I don't understand how people can play it, but there's people that can.
The same as your vocals. You move, tighten and loosen. You move up and down.
Huh. All right. That works for me. there's also some weirder ones. There's this thing called the blaster beam, which is like a metal cylinder. And it's like on a slide guitar, almost. It's got like 10 strings on it, though. And as near as I can tell, you just kind of move it up and down the slide guitar looking thing and just bang the crap out of it with like another stick. There's also the... Oh, I thought I had the pronunciation of this. I'm going to mess it up. Andes Martinet. Martineau. Mm. Something... It's like a combination between a piano and a slide guitar. It's like a slide piano, if you can imagine that. So it looks sort of like a piano, but it's more mechanical. Sounds like a theremin, but it's got these more abrasive sounds. Like I would say a theremin is more
smooth.
Fluid. Yeah. And this is more like gravelly.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why the music box is so... kind of creepy sounding because it sounds like little tiny hammers hitting something.
Well, it is. Lastly, the last one I want to talk about is this thing called the apprehension engine. It was invented by this guy named Tony Dugan Smith. And I don't know if you guys have seen pictures of this thing, but it's basically like 10 instruments in one. There's these metal rods here. There's also these like little metal planks here that you hit with a rod. There's all kinds of like pieces of metal that you just like hit.
How do you get that job? Designing horror instruments.
I don't know. This dude just like built it for himself. And there's like a 5-minute video on YouTube of him just like playing different parts of it. It's pretty effective. I mean, it's got everything you want.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like 10 different instruments on there, so you can't really go wrong.
Well, yeah, but I think it comes back, like we were saying before, about like the texture or the timbre of something.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'll use a lot of like loops of people like hitting beer bottles and buckets instead of the traditional drums, having just these little like clackety-clack things happening, and it's like... When you think of horror stuff, that's kind of what you think of more.
Yeah, and it's weird. I've heard your stuff. I love your stuff. And I listen to True Crime Garage all the time, too, with Desiree.
Fanboy.
Well, come on. And
you got to like something, right?
Yeah. That's the thing I picked, Nicholas. Yeah. Jesus.
Dude, I've been listening to a bunch of just like different True Crime podcasts, and I can't stop. And it's your fault, actually.
Thank you.
So
it's actually I had started podcasting. And Desiree had been listening. It's the only podcast that we both listen to.
Yeah.
It's True Crime Garage. When we go on long trips and everything, we rescue a lot of dogs and we bring them all over and we're listening to your music. But you use, I notice all the stuff that you use. And when you go off and you're not using a normal snare drum, but you're using a bucket, or a beer yeah. bottle, it makes a difference.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, and I think the thing about our show, which a lot of times, if it doesn't sound like a horror tune, it's going to sound, a lot of people say that I sound like explosions in the sky.
Sure. More ambient.
I yeah, love explosions in the sky.
Yeah, I know you
and
do.
Like, but to me, though, I'm like, oh, but that's easy. Like, the scary stuff gets more complicated.
Yeah. Explosions in the sky is just play a guitar and put a bunch of reverb on it.
Yeah, and pick a couple pretty chords, and that's basically it.
Well,
but what one of the things that I kind of want to bring up, and which just kind of hit me as we're talking, but this like list of tune. So I looked up all these different top 10 horror song list.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was Halloween was always so low on the list.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Like the first two or three lists I looked up, it was like number 10. And I was like, wait a second. This is the only tune that you can actually sing.
I know. That's a theme song that I knew what movie it belonged to before I had ever seen the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I started looking at some of these. Some of them are awful.
Yep.
What do you got?
Like,
do you have them?
Well, okay. Like, the Saw theme is actually pretty good. Like, it's pretty good. It's kind of carnival sounding. There's definitely some creepy
like
textures.
I might argue better than the movies. Yeah. I'm just saying.
Yeah, possibly. And then Nightmare on Elm Street, I think, is pretty good. But then, like, all these other ones. And Dead Silence, I thought was pretty good.
I don't think I know that one.
But, like, The Exorcist, Silent Hill, Child's Play, Puppet Masters.
So
they were just kind of like, ugh. You know, like, but I figured out why.
Yes, go on, please.
Okay, because first of all, okay, so Halloween was written by John Carpenter, which wrote the movie Halloween.
Yeah.
So why is the director writing the theme? Because they have no money to hire a composer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know the story behind that song, but it was a piano exercise that his dad made him play.
Really?
So, dun 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 dun. And there's not too many popular songs in five. Okay, so when I say in five, that means there's five beats in the measure.
Yeah.
So it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2.
Dun, 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 and then it starts over.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 1, 2.
Yeah, and if you want to think about counting in five, you know, the theme comes in. Da, 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 da. But it's easy to count once the background notes come in. You know, they change every five. And sometimes they hold out for 10 beats. But it's funny to me. It was just this weird... Because I think they actually hired somebody to write some stuff. And John Carpenter was just like, yeah, that's not it. But John Carpenter was a pretty good piano player. So he's like... He started just messing with this... exercise that his dad gave him to teach him how to count in five.
That's awesome.
And so he did that, and then I think he actually added the bass notes, you know, bomb, bomb, bomb. But have you heard the new Trent Reznor version?
We did. Yeah. We actually listened to that just before recording because we know you wanted to talk about it.
Yeah.
And it's just so rad. Good.
It's so minimal, and it's so, yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, well, I might play a clip of that. Very simple instruments, which I think is interesting. It doesn't go to the lengths of some other people and is still very effective. I was actually listening to the Halloween theme at work like 3 days ago. My coworker changed it because she's like, this is just too creepy for me. I'm like, nah, dude, it's a classic. It's great.
Think about how effective that is, that it's dun, 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 dun. It's three notes.
Yeah.
The whole thing. And it's maybe more well known than its film.
Yeah. And
yeah, well, I mean, it was more than three notes, but it's a three note pattern that they keep altering where it starts.
Yeah.
So it's really, you know, essentially it's three notes, but maybe, it, again, if you look at the list, and I have a bigger list here of other stuff, but And you could argue that Jaws is a little bit. But what's interesting here, I think, like with Jason, all the Jason movies, they use sound in the same way that Jaws did. Like where did you guys watch the Spielberg documentary? They were just talking, but they were talking about how I think it was John Williams did the Jaws thing. But the whole thing about the Jaws thing was the music would start off slow. Yeah. And then get faster to build that tension. But it's the same way like the cha-cha-cha-cha.
Yeah. Yeah.
The same thing that happens with Jason movies.
Which is more popular than any songs in that movie.
Which I think that's just a dude going like cha-cha-cha.
It is. But yeah. It's a 70s dude. Yeah. Which is creepier.
Yeah, he probably had like a weird mustache.
He probably had some weird mullet going on. Yeah, you could hear it.
They're like, hey man, that's too much party in the back for me.
I'd be interested, just going back to the Halloween theme, I'd be interested to know how far apart those notes are, because I was going to save this for a little bit later. This is one of the more effective things that people can do for horror music. This is where some of the science comes in. They've gotten it down to two notes that are three steps apart are apparently the most spooky, and I don't know, spooky or dissonant or whatever you want to call it.
Well, let's go over this because
yeah,
this three notes apart thing doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But so normally you take like a minor key,
like a minor second is the most dissonant note combination you could use.
To me? I'm five.
So real quick, you're going to be the expert on this, Captain. So let me jump in with my amateur explanation first.
I'm even lower than that.
Yeah. When I was in a hardcore band, all the you pick up an instrument and you start playing, right?
Yeah.
And there's a certain recipe for making hardcore music where you have to have your verse, your chorus, and your breakdown.
Yeah.
And your breakdown is where everyone's going to dance.
Yeah.
So during your breakdown, you want to make it as hardcore as possible. So you got bands like Norma Jean, and you got like all these old school hardcore bands that use minor seconds. But if you don't know about music theory, you know them as horror chords, right? Sure. That's what some of my friends that weren't musically inclined would call them. It's basically a minor second. It's one chord, one note, move up one other note, play them at the same time. Super dissonant and uncomfortable. And you just use it rhythmically. Right?
Yeah.
That's a minor second. What you're saying for three notes apart,
tritones.
Still going to be dissonant, tritone. It's not going to be as dissonant as a minor second. And that ends my amateur explanation, Captain.
But the thing is, okay, so let's just talk a little bit theory to make it make sense.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that, you know, you normally have seven notes in a scale. Once you get to the eighth note, you're repeating yourself.
Uh-huh.
But now there's a couple notes, like way back in the day, you couldn't use a diminished fifth. Because that was known as the devil's note.
Can you explain that to me? Sorry.
Well, let me play it and then you can... So here's a perfect fifth. So basically, like, the thing is like you take any scale, any major scale or minor scale.
Yep.
And you have this pattern. And if you heard a minor scale... or a major scale, you'd go, oh, I've heard that before. And if you heard a minor one, you'd go, oh, I've heard that before.
It's a happy scale or a sad scale to non-musicians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. This one sounds happy and this one sounds sad. And if you start playing the wrong notes, like the ones that aren't in the scale with, you know, just that's not in the scale.
Yeah.
Those are normally the creepy tones.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay.
So if that makes probably zero sense. But,
I think I understand, actually. So,
well, if you want to talk about conditioning, like we talked about how when we were kids, you're conditioned to think music boxes are creepy or whatever. You're conditioned with all of music, that all of music is,
for the most part, is
normal. It's in a scale.
Like middle C.
You get out of the major scale, the minor scale, you start getting into weird augmented things, and yeah, it sounds weird. So you're totally right. He's right on.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, we interviewed James Renner. Do you guys know much about the Mara Murray case?
No.
Okay, so Oxygen is doing a six-part documentary on the Mara Murray case. It was a girl that went missing, I think 2000. I don't have my dates in front of me. I think 2004, I think.
Yeah.
So, but he was talking about, you know, how true crime is becoming like a big thing, a big fad, but it's also about like the conditioning of us. Yeah. And so what I was trying to explain it to him is it's kind of like jazz. Did you guys see the Ryan Gosling Saturday Night Live opening where he talks about jazz?
Yeah.
Save jazz. But the thing about jazz or some of these other forms of music is they venture away from the typical scales.
Uh-huh.
And so it's basically these little color tones and these little wrong notes. The more you play them, the more they don't sound wrong to you.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So I think with horror music especially, it's just tones that people aren't used to hearing.
Yeah.
And so and they don't hear them other than around October.
Yep.
You know, every year it comes around and it's like, oh, well, that's creepy.
We play a Halloween playlist at work in our office.
Well, did you guys hear Mother?
I haven't seen it or heard anything.
Just watch the trailer because that music to me, like what we're talking about with Trent Reznor. Trent Reznor's composition skills, and I was working with this composer in Nashville, and I was telling him, like, my problem with composing is I'm to the point where everything is 5 tracks, 10 tracks, sometimes 15 tracks.
Yeah.
Trent Reznor will compose something. If you listen to, like, the theme for Social Network, it's like 2 instruments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 2 tracks, and super, it's amazing. Minimal. Super minimal, and it's just freaking amazing. But I also think that's because he has like a, I blame it on the fact that he uses a Voyager. It's like this $5,000 synthesizer.
Yeah.
So I'm like, it's because of that.
That's why.
But
beyond that, he'll spend a lot more time on like the most obscure part of it. Like, how long do I want this attack to last on this?
Right.
Yeah.
Stuff like, you know, and it's just one thing. He'll make sure that 1 instrument or 2 instruments sound good. And you talked about the Halloween theme that he covered with Attica. And it was just, I think it's probably 2 things. He does cover the like creepy background, like ambience. And then there's like a little dinky, like beep, 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 beep. It's not even a piano.
Yeah.
But he does it so well.
Yeah.
Well, what I think is neat is, so I try to think of it in a couple ways. Is one, am I going to be minimal?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if I'm, but then am I going to be, is the tune that I'm working with going to be melody driven? So is there a melody?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it going to be a texture driven? So I mean, so it's either going to have something that you can hum along to, or there's going to be some kind of texture about it. You know, like just the creepy me banging on metal or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but I think, I guess the sad thing about a lot of these themes for the horror genre is the lack of melody.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just like a lot of just random chord hitting, which is dissonant in and of itself, but I don't think it's entirely effective.
I started thinking about, in regards to this, I thought that it might come up what our favorite soundtracks were.
Oh, yeah, I was going to save that for the end, which I think I don't have much else to say, so we can get into it if you like.
One more thought on that, that idea I was saying is the other thing, though, too, is it when you pick a texture, then what texture is that? So, like we were talking about the Halloween theme, that is very, like, synth-driven. Or like I don't even know if I like Stranger Things as a show. I have no clue, but I learned how to play all 3 major themes.
Hell yeah!
And there's like a whole tutorial online how they got the sounds, and I've watched it like 300 times.
Dude, let's
seek that out.
What I was going to get into with my favorites is I cannot get away from my favorite, like, just Stranger Things is the perfect soundtrack. It's just perfect. That It Follows. is an amazing horror soundtrack. Yeah, like, I just love that 80s synthy, like, super, like, let's just dive into this and stick to a theme deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love that the synth texture.
Yep.
But it does give you that 80s, late 70s vibe. But yeah. What I've been into lately is very organic, very acoustic-based instruments and how to make those creepy.
Yeah.
And when you listen to, I'm telling you, you just got to watch the trailer to Mother.
Yeah.
And it's primarily just, you know, like a string quartet, but the way they're just like banging on the instruments and using them in a very odd way.
Yeah.
That's almost a creepy thing in itself.
Yeah.
We'll watch that after this. Absolutely. I heard it's just consistent tension the entire film too. Yeah, so that makes sense.
I want to see that, but I do want to ask you guys though, if you had to choose like one or two horror soundtracks or theme songs or elements from a movie or something, what would be your favorite?
For composing, if I was going to make something.
I just mean, like, if you were to seek out, like, I want to listen to the soundtrack of...
Oh, anything. All these modern 80s throwback movies that have, like the Stranger Things soundtrack, the It Follows soundtrack.
Yeah.
That gets me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think my...
Because it's melodic, but it's still got that creepiness electronically.
Yeah.
So I love that.
I really like It Follows as well. The day after I went and saw It, I wasn't creeped out enough by the movie It. So I listened to the soundtrack to It Follows, and that did a much better job than it did.
Well, look, I looked back. I thought, like, one of them would jump out other than Halloween, and nothing did.
It's
like
hard. I listened to so many playlists preparing for this as well. I'm sorry to interject, but...
No.
Your pain.
Jerk.
Yeah, but no, but it was actually very disappointing. And it was, like, back to my point of probably the reason why this is bad... is because it's like the last thing. And most of these movies initially have an awful budget. I mean, because have you guys, because Iowa, wasn't that where Halloween took place?
Wasn't it Indiana?
I don't know,
It was either Indiana or Iowa.
I don't think
but
it
was.
I'm much more proud of it if it was.
Well, it was shot in, LA, right?
Yeah.
And so they had to carry around like a couple bags of leaves.
Yeah.
Like,
that's right.
And they had to keep collecting the leaves because they didn't.
That's funny.
Because they're like, we don't have any leaves.
I think I remember thinking that as I was watching it. I was like, this takes place around. I think it's Indiana, but like all of the trees were green. And I'm like, it's
October.
Hold
on a second. I know I've seen that specific leaf three times already.
I wasn't going to go that specific.
The one with the rip in it. Like, yeah.
There's no falling leaves. Like all these trees are too green for October in the Midwest.
Oh, it was Illinois.
Illinois.
There you go.
Hey,
no,
close.
We're both wrong.
We're 2 hours away.
No, I. Circling back on Halloween and a lot of the 80s movies for that matter, like the first couple Fridays, Nightmare on Elm Street to a certain extent, is there's this brilliance in innovation through limitation.
Yeah.
So like they didn't have a budget, so John Carpenter did it, and maybe he's not the best musician, so maybe that made it a little more creepy. Or there's this sort of dissonance with the environment. It's supposed to take place in Illinois, and it... Or like even Camp Crystal Lake and Friday the 13th,
right.
It's filmed in California. And like you can see people's breath in the middle of summer because they filmed it during the winter. So there's like all this weird dissonance that adds this like innovation to it that I think we need to get back to. Like you have all these blockbuster horror movies. They don't do anything for me because they put too much money into it.
Yeah.
Well, it's like Blair Witch. You know, because what they did there is, hey, we're going to, it's a big budget movie on some level, but as far as the technology, you're going to have a camera and we're going to set limitations and therefore, it's going to come off as more authentic.
Yeah.
Where I get scared of us going the wrong way and heading back to that is all the stupid paranormal activity 7 or 8 or whatever they're up to. Because I feel like they took that idea and they tried to blockbusterize it.
Yeah, I wonder what the next one will be. I don't know. I just, not even, like, equipment Yeah, that'd be super cool. But I even just mean, like, go back to practical effects. Mm. Don't mm-hmm. spend a bunch of money on CGI for a monster. Just don't show the monster, because that's scarier. My imagination right. is more scary than anything you can show me.
We've been doing for this month, we call it October month.
Yeah, that's our seasonal tag.
Seasonal spooky month. And we had, at the end of every episode, we recommend movies that we want each other to watch or our listeners to watch. And I made Nick watch From Beyond, so we watched it together today.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the practical effects of that are just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say
it's... It just made me uncomfortable.
It's just very uncomfortable. That's the thing that they're aiming for more than creepy, because that movie's ridiculous. But it's weird to actually physically see it. Yeah. I feel like it almost has the same effect as the what we were talking about before with the reverb, where you could feel like someone's in the room, but it's not synthetic. Right. You could tell the difference sometimes.
Yeah. No.
So Halloween.
Yeah, I just think that's the best one.
It's good.
And to the funny thing to me is, if it came from just some exercise his father gave him, like how crazy is that? Like that, and it's the most recognizable one. I mean, we all recognize the
you know.
But like, other than that, if I said, "Hey, hum the Ring theme."
Good luck.
I'll give you $1 million. Yeah, it's not happening. And maybe we're wrong. Maybe we're missing some that are really good, but I don't know of any other than the Halloween theme,
which is
Stranger Things. But that's not a movie. And then I'd argue that's
the other thing that's tough is if it's too modern, it's hard to include it on my favorite list.
Yeah,
because you think, oh, there's all the stuff that came before it. I might be missing something. That's how I feel personally, at least.
Yeah,
but
when you hear Mother though.
We'll listen to it after like, we're done recording.
I mean, because I've been doing all this work for these production companies, and like, if they say, "Oh, try to make something sound like Ben Folds," or they say, "Try to make it sound like whatever,"
yeah,
I can get pretty close. But I heard this stuff in the Mother. I think we got paid to do an ad, like to promote the thing.
Yeah.
So I was like, I need to watch at least the trailer.
Yeah,
and I probably watch it like 5 or 6 times because it's like, I don't know how to do that on my own. Like I could hire an orchestra to maybe help me do that, but I can't do that in my little studio, which I thought was interesting. There is a big gap and they need good composers.
Yeah.
And the horror movie genre.
Yeah.
And you need to start studying.
Yeah.
Learn your augmented fifths and your diminished fifths. You'll be fine. In your tritones. Yeah. Yep. If you get those down, you're good. But what we have established is that it's a weak market.
Yeah.
And we need composers to dive in. But I think on the other side of things, all these Child's Play and Puppet Masters, all these have weak themes other than Halloween. Because mm-hmm. I'm just going to say everything's crap other than Halloween. But I think all of these do a really good job of the Foley work and the tension work, like the background music. It might not be the theme, but it's the, we're going to have some weird noises to create the tension for the jump scare or whatever.
Yeah.
They're all great at that, but the actual themes, a little weak.
Yeah, that's what I loved about
Unmemorable, Happy Death Day. I would say.
But yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What I loved about Happy Death Day was their ability to create tension, because it wasn't all that scary, but it was pretty friggin' tense, and they did it like with club music at one point. I was like, that is really interesting. Yeah. I've never had a horror movie create tension with club bangers, so that was pretty fun.
My favorite recently was I rewatched Funny Games.
Yeah.
And they just put on straight up grindcore.
Yeah.
But it's not a soundtrack, it's in the film. They hit play on a CD player, and I love when that happens. Yeah. When it's in the moment, because again, that adds to the space. I think we did pretty good, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. We'll just give ourselves pats on the back, you know.
Should we wrap this up and put a nice little bow on it?
Yeah, let's do that. Did we have any listener questions or anything?
I got a couple. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back and I got some questions.
Okay.
I, using musical theory, have created order out of chaos.
I'm picking up a heavy, creepy vibe here.
First, let's remind people, if they want to hear more from the captain, where they can find you.
Yeah, you can check out the show on any podcast platform to search the show True Crime Garage. Mm-hmm. TrueCrimeGarage.com. I have my own website for music, but I'm really bad at updating it because the podcast has taken over my life.
Yeah.
So
I looked at it recently. I liked you still have a pretty professional, you know, polished look up there. Yeah. You had some recent stuff that you did for commercials that I was watching too.
Weirdo. Yeah, which was fun. Yeah, yeah. I do some work for a Australian production company.
Yeah, oh, nice. That was cool.
That they're sweet. The only people that will hire me. Nobody else has hired me.
We'd hire you.
I just get my friends to hire me. So.
Well, I need more friends.
Yeah. So let's. Also, if you want to find us, you can find us on Twitter, Stranger Soul, and
StrangerSoulShow.com, yeah. etc.
You found us, and you're listening to this now, so
yep,
you know where to find us. Anyway, we like to put up questions on Facebook and see what people want to be answered in the show. I've got a few here. I think that I will kind of posit these. I asked for both horror music related questions and true crime related questions specifically for the captain. So I got just a handful here. So Nikki E wanted to know, why am I so obsessed with true crime? And why does it seem to be mostly dominated by women? Which is her perspective.
Can I start?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so this is kind of strange because if you go back 10, 15 years, it was not typically known as a female genre. Uh-huh. It was mainly a male genre. And so it's actually surprising to a lot of people. A lot of my friends that have been into true crime for a long time, you know, they'll say, why did you guys do a girl hair product
yeah.
ad? And we go, well, because, you know, 80% of our listeners are females. And yeah. they're always taken back by that. You know, there's a bunch of documentaries now on why we like these things. And do you guys know the author James Renner? He's a true crime writer. He's from Ohio. He came down and hung out with us a couple weeks ago. His thought was that true crime is, you know, it's very popular, and it's very popular with women. I think a lot of the stuff is, you know, we hear these crazy stories. And I think there's two things about it. Like, some people really like the solved crimes.
Yeah.
You know, like, and because then you get to know why.
You get closure.
you normally get closure.
I'll attest to that.
Yeah. And I personally, my three favorite cases are all unsolved. And I constantly Google stuff about them and try to see if there's any new information.
Yeah.
But I like the process of thinking about the case yeah. and going down the rabbit holes and creating those things. But this kind of goes hand in hand with the music, though, is because, like what we're saying before, is like I think a lot of people are now gravitating towards the unsolved cases because they don't mind the tension.
The mystery, yeah.
Well, but with an unsolved case, there's tension
yeah.
because it's you have tension and there's no release. There's no resolve. And it's like what we're talking about with music theory. At first, certain notes sound good.
Yeah.
And the wrong notes sound wrong. But the more you have that tension, the more it doesn't seem that odd. So that's kind of what me and this author were talking about is there's all these really popular cases popping up that aren't solved. And it's almost like now people will say, yeah, we want this solved and we want resolution. But I don't think they care as much because they're so used to that tension
that it
doesn't feel unfamiliar anymore.
Yeah.
I like that.
Absolutely.
But I don't know why it's gravitating towards women, though.
That is a very interesting thing, and I guess I didn't really realize it.
I want to see statistics on that before
Your listener base is like 80% women, you said?
I actually have no clue. I know that based off of like our surveys and stuff that our agent has done, it's like a big majority are female, but then I'd argue, well, how many men are listening to the show that just didn't want to take the online survey? Or, you know, Nick, for example, has zero social media accounts. So the majority of our Instagram followers or Twitter followers might be female. But how many men are listening out there that just don't use social media, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, when you said that you had the hair product ad, I know that Generation Y does that a lot, too. And it's just, I don't know.
Speak for yourself, dude, though, because, like,
it worked really
Tresemme
well
makes my day, is what I'm trying to say. Well, if you go to StrangerDeals.com/Tresemme, you can say 50%. Oh, okay.
But I also find it, this is kind of another tangent we might go down, so I'll try to keep it as contained as I can, but I was thinking recently, I've been watching a lot of 80s horror movies. Like I've been on a Friday the 13th bend lately. I watched Halloween, I watched even Happy Death Day. Like there's always, almost always a final girl, and I don't know why that is either. Like it centers around women, which is great because these are strong, empowered women. But I can't tell you where that came from.
No, that's pretty awesome. You know, I've never really thought about it because I mean, when's the last time it was just like, you know, some dude standing there like, yep, I won.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's just not as appeal. I don't know.
I wonder if it goes into a weird psychological thing where in the United States, men are in power, and so that. There's a weird dynamic. So showing women in power is more realistic because the men are the scary ones that are going to try to get you in the movie.
I don't know.
Well, but also maybe it's also the idea that, you know, they kind of allude to a little bit, you know, especially like with Mike Meyer or Jason, that like they also pine for one of these women. So it's like, well, I'll kill all these people, but I don't know if I want to kill this one. So maybe that's something to do with it as well.
That'd be cool.
I'm sure those
intertwine
somehow. Maybe we'll be able to do an episode about it next year.
Yeah.
If we can figure out a way to research that.
But leading ladies in horror.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. There we go. Next question comes from Jason L. He asked, is there an objectively scariest chord instrument or tempo? I feel like we kind of answered that. Like you said, the diminishing fifths. Is that what it's called?
And D minor from Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, diminished. Yeah. Well, just back in the day, I believe it was actually a law at one point where you could not use a diminished fifth because they called it double chord. So
it's so awesome.
It's so like arcane. something I wanted to circle back to in regards to tempo, you talked about how it's like the fifth beat or whatever. I think we're so used to 4/4 that anything outside of that is a little jarring as well. So that might have something to do with
it. It's got more of a swing to it.
Yeah.
It's creepier.
I think there's a lot of songs that are in 7 or 6/8 or 3/4, which aren't super odd times, but they don't sound odd to our ear. They compose them in such a way that it just kind of really seems normal. But sometimes with things like in 5, I think
it's just weird enough,
you know, I don't even think most people would know like, oh, this something's wrong here. I think it's a subconscious thing.
Last question here also from Jason. I think we kind of answered this already. He wanted to know why we think, things like Serial, Making a Murderer, and all that are as popular as they are.
Well, that's a different question than true crime, though, because I got into Serial a year and a half, 2 years later than it was popular.
I haven't downloaded it on my phone. I haven't listened to it.
I haven't either.
You've never listened to it. What's interesting to me lately, I'm like a reverse hipster.
You'll listen to stuff
so it's like,
after it's cool.
Yeah, so it's like somebody's like, hey, man, you should check out Stranger Things, and like then season 2's out, and I'm like, hey, man, guess what I'm watching? Stranger Things. It's great. No, but like with Serial, like I think the interesting – and I've been preaching this for the last year, and not a lot of people have agreed with me. We just got to do a really cool interview with Huffington Post, and I was like – thought I was telling her something special. Like, well, you know, why are certain cases bigger than other cases? First of all, the event is normally very small and there's normally not a lot of detail about it, but we have tons of details beforehand and afterhand. Yeah. And what I think our brains like to do is take like the serial case, which you guys don't know anything about it, but the girl went missing and they didn't start interviewing students from her school like for 3 weeks. So then it becomes, did they get something wrong? And so you just have, you have 20 pieces of the yeah. puzzle, and you could argue each piece of the puzzle a different way. And I think the reason why people love those cases is because it's a rabbit hole with every little piece
Absolutely,
of evidence.
Yeah.
And like I said, my father's a detective. I've set him down and talked to him about the Adnan Syed case. I've set him talk to him about the Mara Murray case. Some of these big cases, JonBenet Ramsey, me and my father have talked about a lot. And he's a detective, yeah. and he's one, but he'll tell you, yeah, this one piece of information that people keep talking about over and over could mean nothing.
Yeah.
You know, it could
circles.
Be the, yeah. yeah, it could be the biggest break in the case, or it could mean nothing. And so, I think a lot of these cases that are, have got really big, I think it's simple. I think people like to try to figure things out.
Yeah.
I think,
it's like a puzzle.
I think, it's like the Brandon Lawson case. The reason why that's so big of a case is because here's this guy that breaks down, calls 911. It's like a 2 minute long conversation. You can almost hear everything he's saying.
Uh-huh.
He eventually calls his brother again and then disappears off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
And the first time I heard that phone call, I said, oh my God, I can solve this.
Yeah.
And but almost everybody I've ever played that for was like, oh, play it again. I could tell you what he's saying.
Yeah.
And that was the point of the episode we did, was I broke it down line by line by line by line.
Very good episode.
Slower.
Yeah.
And it was to show that, you know, I actually thought when I the funny thing is I think it was like midnight the first time I ever listened to it. And I was like, I'm just going to put it into my recording system. And mess with it for a little bit, and it was like 6 a.m. by the time I stopped. but it's one of those things that you think you can solve, and I think some of these cases have become so big. And it's not all cases. I think people think in general, like, true crime is huge right now. Uh-huh. I would argue that there's a handful of cases that are huge that people talk about. Uh-huh. But the whole genre itself, I don't know if the whole genre has blown up, because... And I think it's also in circles. Like, I've been following this Mara Murray case for a long time. I've watched every, it's a 6-part documentary. I've turned off football games to watch it.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's big in my world.
Yeah.
But I don't think most people are watching this show.
Sure.
So I don't know. And I also think Serial is like a weird one, because I think the average age of podcast listeners are probably like late 20s to late 30s, and it happened in 1999, so it's a time period that we know.
Yeah,
it's kind of like Columbine.
Oh,
Columbine
absolutely.
Is really big, but I think a lot of that goes back to nostalgia. You know, like, I was in high school at the time, you guys were probably middle school or elementary
in
school.
My mommy's belly.
No, you weren't.
No, I was young. Yeah, it's weird to think, like, when you think back on a case and when it happened, where was I at the time?
Yeah.
And even when, like, I remember, and not to get too dark, but when 9/11 happened, one of the things that, the first thing people ask you, because I'm from New York, where were you at the time?
Yeah.
What
yeah.
were you doing? And it adds another layer to it.
Well, it makes becomes you, personal at that point.
It becomes personal and more real.
Yeah.
Because it's not like history anymore. It's, I was alive when this happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also think that's this, you know, maybe, like I said, there's big cases in true crime, but maybe if the whole genre is bigger right now, I think a lot of that stuff is because they're all human stories.
Yeah.
And almost every story that you, and the crazy thing about it too, and I don't think we dive into this enough, but the crazy thing about it is the killers, we normally have a lot in common with them, but we don't talk about
that
stuff.
That's one thing that I think is another appeal to true crime, is this. I think there are some people out there who just want to know what make these people tick. Like,
yeah,
there might be some people that are like, oh, I could fix this person. But then there's also people that are like, well, this person seemed like a totally normal person. What went wrong? I need to know. either, I don't know if it's a survival thing or just like the human's need for drama or what it is, but yeah. I think that's a big draw.
Our brains fill in the cracks.
Yeah. Our brains fill in the cracks. Yeah. And I think the weird thing for me, though, is, you know, when we started the show, I used to tell people, we would get into Nick's garage and we'd talk.
Yeah.
And it would be about, you know, music or movies. But we always went back to true crime because my father's a detective. His father's a detective. That's something we don't talk about a lot on the show. But when, you know, it's like having a preacher for a dad.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like only another guy that has a detective. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He knows what I go through because he has to have the same conversations with his father.
Yeah.
Yep.
So there's also like there was this weird rumor that Nick was my father.
Is he?
No.
Okay. So we got the first. That's the first time he's ever answered that on the air. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. we have the exclusive answer.
This is all
Nick's not my father. And then a lot of people think that we're related because I've known him since like basically kindergarten.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But he always talked true crime, but when he said true crime, like I was nervous a little bit because I love diving into certain cases, and there's tons of cases that I know more about the case than he does. But I also back away from it a lot because I know that sometimes it's like it's too dark,
yeah.
It's too depressing.
Yeah. So
sometimes
that's something I was curious about because our show changes topics. We talk about salt lamps and how they're not real.
And we talk about right. Santa Claus being white.
Yeah, and
but isn't there a placebo effect with the salt lamps?
We
got into that, and some of it is.
We're gonna have to listen to that episode,
dude. We went into essential oils, and we're like, this is garbage. There's no science in this, and we found that like it actually killed germs, and there's some placebo effect in lavender oils and stuff.
We went
too.
On a debunking spree, so I was like, let's debunk essential oils, and then I found out there's actually some science too. I was so pissed off.
Yeah, so the difference in that is like. It can be light and fun, and we've delved into other things.
Uh-huh.
We've delved into topics like about racism and
we've
like
talked about. I did an episode with my brother.
But depression,
like having a creative mind, make you more depressed. Like,
yeah,
that was a very dark episode.
Our show versus yours is you have. There's a darkness that's always going to be there.
Uh-huh.
How do you separate that? And like when you go into your personal life, you say you're talking about this with Nick in his garage in your free time, and it's not for the show. Has it just become so commonplace that it's easy to talk about, or are there points where you're like,
do you set limits?
Yeah, are there limits in that?
Okay. Well, a couple things. I think first, I think I've learned a lot because you know I do get to hang out with retired detectives, and so the way that I approach cases before, the way I talk to them about with the detectives, because you know. I'll bring something out to my father, but if he doesn't get it, or sometimes he doesn't care, you know, because he's retired. He did over 4,000 missing person cases. So sometimes I can bring up a missing person case and he'll listen. Sometimes he just says, call my ex-partner or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'll call him. But I know that my knowledge, I think my hunches are getting a little bit better.
Yeah.
I also am... lately, and this is kind of bad for the show, is it's sometimes it's better to have like an uninformed, unintelligent opinion and just rant and rave about something.
Yeah.
Sometimes it makes better, you know, to have somebody question everything. But the case we're covering right now, Kyron Horman, the stepmother seems guilty as sin.
Yeah.
The problem with it is this timeline is very shaky. And so I'm really trying to get to the bottom of that. So a year ago, I probably would have been calling her a horrible person and she's awful and she's guilty of sin.
Yeah.
Now I'm going, why doesn't this timeline make sense? And maybe that can help my thought process later. And I always try to be really open-minded about a case, but I feel like as I get older and wiser about cases, I tend to stay open longer and I don't get so tunnel vision, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
But, whether it was the, I mean, Nick cried multiple times during the Casey Anthony when we recorded that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was weird. I mean, and like somebody would hear that and go, oh my God, why is he crying? What a sissy. But, you know, Nick's a grandfather. And so there was a suicide note from the grandfather, and he was trying to read that. Well, it started sounding like it was coming from his thoughts.
Yeah.
And I can't. And then I think last week Nick was fed up, and I think it was 2 weeks ago. Like, there's been so many weeks that, you know, our show has been super successful, and you know, I'm a musician that, you know, I've never been in Rolling Stone till I did a podcast.
yeah.
You know, Huffington Post is calling you. I'm watching the Oxygen documentary, and the host of the show messaged me to say, hey, I like your show. And I was like, I like watching your show. It's like, it's like unreal.
Surreal.
And
he,
yeah,
you know,
that's pretty cool, though.
But there's been so many weeks that he wanted to quit, or I wanted to quit, and I question, are we doing any good here, or is this just too much? And my father, I used to make fun of my dad all the time because he walked out of Jurassic Park because of the goat. And I used to just make
Poor
fun
guy.
Of him. And, well, my dad said to me, that's what I see for a living, but with humans, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to ever see that again. And I used to make fun of him, and now it's to the point where it's like I can't make fun of him anymore, because like he was, when he retired, let me just tell the story. I find this story fascinating. My dad never really talked about what he did. So when I was a kid, he was the guy with the cop car that would turn on the lights for me, and that was it. And then he became a detective. I had no clue that he specialized in sexual abuse cases and missing person cases till later on in life. He never talked to me about what he did. I had zero clue. Like, people could say, my dad works in this building and in this office. And I'm like, my dad works in the police building, and I've never seen his office, because he yeah. doesn't talk about it. But you're not supposed to talk about cases.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'd disappear for 3 or 4 days, and he'd like show back up, and he'd have a beard. But, But he retired pretty young, and I came home one night in high school, and he was pissed drunk, which my dad didn't drink, because he suffers from the depression. So
yeah.
He's like, but
well,
he was
understandably so.
Yeah, so he's drinking by himself. He's at the kitchen table. All the lights are off, and that's when I just knew something's wrong. He's sitting in there dark, and I'm like, Dad, you okay? And he just kept on saying, he stabbed her 40 times. And he repeated that, like, a lot. And I didn't even know what to do. So I just was like, yeah, I'm sorry about that. And I just went to bed. And I just remember thinking, this is, you know, they stabbed, or he stabbed her 40 times. And now that I'm older, I asked him about it. I said, do you remember being drunk? He said they stabbed her 40 times. And he told me it was his first day on the job. He gets there and they say, hey, go guard this gas station and don't let anybody in or out. And he was just a police officer.
Yeah.
And so he sat at the front door of that gas station, and the detectives came in and out. And as they're coming in and out, they're explaining to my father what happened. And this guy went to rob a gas station, and the lady recognized him. So he stabbed her for like 40 some times.
Holy crap.
And then, at some point the detectives made my dad watch the body. And so, you know, he worked for the law enforcement for 20 some years, and then 20 years goes by, and next thing you know, you're on your kitchen table crying and saying that they stabbed her 40
yeah.
times. So I don't know. Look, all the armchair detectives, look, and like I just said, I just got done saying, I think I'm better at this than I was a year ago.
Yeah.
And maybe 3 years I'll get even better. But my dad is not some genius guy that could figure out a bunch of stuff. He was just a hardworking guy.
Uh-huh.
But for whatever reason, he has the tools to try to block that stuff out or not watch that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So I think when we're looking at it, every case is, I think every case is these puzzle pieces and these what ifs, but it's not fully real.
You and pause and you walk away.
Yeah. And I think if it was fully real, then we'd look at it with different eyes.
Yeah.
So I just got into some dark
stuff. Hey, we just got like in
is there
the valley, but
therapy session, man. This is awesome though.
Yeah, man.
It wasn't my therapy. It was we need to get my dad on here and
yeah,
bring him on.
Have him talk about. No, he Papa won't. When we're doing the whole stuff where they're trying to make our podcast a TV show, the big thing was, you know, well, we want your fathers to be on the show.
Yeah.
Like, here's these two kids that were friends and their dads are detectives. And, but when he'd get interviewed, he'd act so serious and he's just not serious anymore. Like he saw the dark side of life. He doesn't.
Yeah.
And I think it made him bitter for a long time. And then now that he's been away from it so long, I think he actually kind of believes in humanity again. But but that's why when people say, why doesn't your dad listen to the show? My dad doesn't want to hear about this stuff.
He lived it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that this is kind of tangential. And then I think we'll wrap it up. But my grandpa was in World War II and he never talked about it until, I want to say like 10 years ago, this two authors wanted to write the stories of the surviving World War II veterans in Iowa. And that was the only time he had ever talked about it. And like after that, he finally opened up and you could ask him questions about it again. And I just think I can't even put myself in that mind frame. So I can't even say like how I would cope with that sort of situation.
Yeah.
It's just really tough.
Well, we're a bunch of sissies.
Yeah.
Well, you're not wrong.
compared to that generation. Yeah. And same thing. The interesting thing that I found out recently is I think they have multiple copies, but when I was in second grade, I interviewed my grandfather about being in World War II.
Yeah.
And we taped it and it was like the first time anybody in the family ever heard him talk about it. And it was this second grade interview. But
that's both adorable and kind of sad.
Yeah, yeah.
I totally know where you're coming from.
But they found all these tapes, like reel-to-reel tapes. My great uncle used to do like a mock radio show.
Oh, really?
And so, and it was him and my grandpa, and I kind of thought, that how weird is that?
Yeah, it's in the blood.
Yeah, that, I mean, he was just doing it as a joke, and now all of a sudden, this is, you know, my livelihood.
Yeah.
So,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing.
So you got all kinds of generational connections to what you do.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, he was the talker, and then somehow my father did the detective work and
you combine them. Yeah.
But I mean, there's, but back to your question, it's like there's a million times where it's like you wish we were talking about football this week or something. Cause it's every week. And we've talked about this too. Cause sometimes we record twice a week and like a little bit on Monday and a little bit on Tuesday. And we've talked about, hey, maybe we should just do it all in one day so we just have one day of darkness.
So that's kind of sad you have to talk about it like that though.
But look, I'm very lucky. I played music and toured and I did some really cool stuff, but I never made a lot of money doing it. And I was really worried that there wasn't much of a good life for me. And but the show and the audience has, you know, kind of changed a lot of that.
Yeah. Don't ever stop.
Please.
I hope so.
And if you ever you feel the need to talk about salt lamps, you're always welcome to come on the show.
You want to talk about football? We'll find a subject for our show.
Yeah.
Hey, I don't know much about salt lamps, but I know that I want one because I just think they look cool. But
Well, when you go listen to our episode, that's the moral that we say to walk away with. Get them because they look cool, not because you think they'll do something.
10 hours of research and they look pretty.
you guys should do one on lava lamps.
Oh, dude.
We can absolutely do that.
I love lava lamps. I should get one, and then we'll put it right here, and we'll do an episode on it.
Okay,
deal. Oh, that'd be awesome.
Oh, man. Well, we've talked for a long time. I'm losing my voice.
Yeah. You got a lot of editing to do.
I know. That's all good. It's all in the fun. So to close things out, again, thank you so much for coming on our show. I can't thank you enough.
Yeah.
Just make it like a three-parter.
We could stretch it out over a whole month.
You could do it until December, probably. Yeah. Yeah.
It'll be great. But thank you. And I know I had a lot of fun. I hope you did too. Don't speak for me.
You don't know if I had to. I could have been miserable, for all you know.
It was great. He did yawn a bunch.
I yawned like three times, man.
It's because at least six times.
This guy's watching right now. I forgot we had a camera on us over here.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks, everyone, for joining us for October month.
Yep.
Join us next week for another exciting closeout for October month. And I'm still Nick.
I'm still John.
And I'm the captain.
And this is Stranger Still.